Hello, and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that if an asteroid were to hit Earth, it's not the impact that would cause the most casualties. It's the wind, heat, and tsunamis that occur because of it. I admit that this is a very morbid subject, but it is fascinating, and a professor by the name of Clemens Rupf at the University of Southampton in the United Kingdom has calculated the mortality rate if different types of asteroids were to hit the Earth. Of course, there isn't just one type of asteroid disaster. There are those that will get close to the ground but will burn up in a ferocious intensity just above us. But then there are those that will strike land, and there are also those that will hit the water. And for all of these asteroid events, it's surprisingly the airborne and wind side effects of the asteroid's impact that end up costing the most lives. But let's break it down. It's twice as likely that an asteroid would hit one of our large swaths of water. So in that instance, the asteroid would set in motion a tsunami with waves hundreds of feet high. And the farther the impact is from shore, the deeper the water, the taller the waves. So in terms of casualties, researchers created a model. Let's say that an asteroid about 650 feet wide, which would be considered large, hit the waters about 80 miles off of the coast of Rio de Janeiro. According to this research, such an event would kill 50,000 people, but 75% of those people would be killed by the tsunami, the other 25% would be killed by high winds. Things get much worse when an asteroid comes closer to a city. If an asteroid burned up over or in a city, the death toll would be in the millions, and almost entirely due to the high winds and heat, which makes sense since it never hits the ground. But let's say that asteroid does make contact. It would still be the gusting winds and surging temperatures that would kill us. Even the sound waves caused by the asteroid would be enough to rupture our internal organs. In fact, scientists say that the actual asteroid impact would cause the deaths of only 3% of the total killed, and that number even includes impacts resulting in earthquakes and fallen debris, just 3%. Okay, so that's the terrible news. The good news is that large asteroids like that 650-footer don't hit Earth all that often. At best, it's a once in every 40,000 year event. And luck may be on our side because most of our planet's surfaces are actually unpopulated. So the chances are good or better that if it did hit, it hopefully won't be anywhere near us. This week I learned that vultures are fascinatingly revolting and also quite crucial to our ecosystem. The Science and Nature writer Elizabeth Reut has an utterly delightful yet absolutely viscerally disgusting article about vultures for the January issue of National Geographic. There is so much delicious and malicious information to parse out. Like, for example, did you know that vultures have the ability to vomit the entire contents of their stomachs when they're threatened so that they can quickly take flight? As Reut explains, they do also have some redeeming qualities. Rather endearingly, they probably mate for life, they're attentive to their partners, and vultures share parental care of the chicks. What's really cool is that vultures also perform a crucial but underrated ecosystem service. They do the dirty work of cleaning up after death. Vultures consume an unrivaled amount of meat among mammals. Just as one example, during the migration period in the African Serengeti ecosystem, when more than a million wildebeest passed between Kenya and Tanzania, vultures consume more meat than any mammalian carnivores in all of the Serengeti combined. And they do it exceptionally fast. One vulture can eat 2 pounds of meat in a minute. A sizable crowd can reduce a zebra to bones in just 30 minutes. And because they can devour such large animals in such a short amount of time, their stomach acids neutralize dangerous pathogens that would otherwise spread. In fact, vultures' gastric juices are so acidic that they can neutralize rabies, cholera, and anthrax. Without these vultures, a carcass can take nearly 3 times as long to decompose. And during that time, 3 times as many mammals can eat from it, and they're likely to stay for 3 times as long. The problem here is that the longer these animals commune with one another and this carcass, the more likely they are to spread diseases that would have otherwise died in the stomachs of vultures. Those diseases then transfer from the wild animals to livestock, to domesticated animals, and eventually to people. But vultures are a dangerously threatened species. Their reproductive biology isn't helping. They reach maturity relatively late, they produce a chick only once every year or two, and 90% of their young die in the first year. Over the next half century, African vulture populations are projected to decline by up to 97%. Cultural practices and accidental poisonings have also added to this sharp decline in populations. In India, a now banned anti-inflammatory drug that was fed to livestock nearly wiped out vultures completely, but luckily the die-off has slowed since 2006. The scientists in Elizabeth Royt's article say that losing vultures completely would likely set off an ecological and economic catastrophe. This week I learned that the hideous feeling you get when someone scrapes their nails on a chalkboard may be its own separate emotion. Scientists have been trying for a while now to suss out the unpleasantness of this feeling. It seems to produce an aversive emotional reaction that is similar to disgust. And we English speakers don't have a name for it, but Spanish speakers do. They call it grima. And this distinct word allowed researchers to study its effect on the human mind and body, and then compare those reactions to the effects of disgust. Researchers first confirmed that grima for Spanish speakers was different from disgust. Indeed, they said it was worse than disgust. The participants also confirmed the cause was typically from high-pitched squeaking noises, as well as touch, so the act itself, like scratching or touching surfaces. Then, when researchers asked Spanish speakers to suppress their feelings to different sounds that ranged from pleasant to unpleasant disgust and grima, volunteers rated grima sounds as less unpleasant. But what was interesting was that their ratings for disgust-inducing sounds didn't change at all. So then researchers put it to the test with people who didn't have a word for the grima feeling. These were German and American students. These volunteers were treated to an array of audio stimuli from pleasant to disgust and grima type sounds. Researchers measured their physiological reactions and they found that their heart rates differed with grima sounds and with disgust sounds. With grima sounds, their heart rates first fell very slightly and then rose sharply before returning to normal. But disgust or unpleasant sounds showed a different pattern, with a more significant drop in heart rates initially before returning back to normal. Put together, the research suggests that grima isn't just a reflex, but an emotional experience that can be influenced by thought and is distinct from disgust. This week I learned that wild elephants may be getting the least amount of sleep of any mammal. Scientists have long believed that the size of a mammal's body correlates to the amount of sleep it gets. The bigger the animal, the less shut-eye. Domestic horses, for example, sleep just shy of 3 hours per night. The problem has been that it's not so easy to test this theory on really large wild animals. But one recent study outlined in the journal PLOS ONE finally got as close as you're going to get to the sleeping wild. It was, however, an extremely small study. Researchers studied the sleeping habits of 2 female wild African elephants. They were middle-aged matriarchs from different herds. first scientists fitted each elephant with a collar to monitor her location and body position. Scientists also implanted a small movement tracker at the tip of the elephant's trunk, which they removed from the roaming elephants after about a month. What they were looking for were their sleeping positions. Elephants have two. They sleep lying down, which allows them to hit that really deep REM sleep. And they also sleep standing up, but this is a much more shallow snooze. Researchers found that the elephants rarely lay down, really just once every 3 or 4 nights. And this means if they hit that deep REM sleep, it was only once or twice a week. What little shut-eye they did get was of that shallow and brief variety. It was always while standing up and averaged just 2 hours per night. There were even some nights when they just kept walking and never slept at all. By comparison, captive elephants can sleep between 4 and 6 hours per day. So far, the wild elephant's unenviable sleep habits are the fewest hours of sleep of any mammal studied to date. And that does it for this episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. To read more about the facts I've mentioned or to check out more series from The Week, including 7-Minute Opinions and 7-Minute Explainers, go to theweek.com/podcasts. And if you like what you hear, we'd love it if you could take a moment and leave us a rating or review on iTunes. Happy listening!